I mean, she asked you not to talk to your own dad about it? That seems wrong. I don't want to sound mean or anything, but something about your mom bothers me. How can she possibly bother you? I said, rolling my eyes a little. You haven't even seen her since you've been back. Which reminds me, she wants you to come over. She invited you to dinner on Halloween, actually, but you had other plans, said Jared, raising one corner of his mouth and pretending to adjust the fit of his cap by grabbing the bill and twisting it sideways a little. I had other plans, I said, grinning back, hoping that whatever tension he felt would start to fade now. Well, Jared said, one of his eyebrows arched, like the offer of dinner at my house was something he had to think about. I guess I can do that. Just make sure not to leave me alone with your mom. I don't want you to come back into the room after 5 minutes and find that she's lobotomized me for my own good or anything. Shut up, I said, pushing him on the shoulder, and he got one last laugh in before he looked down at where my hand had touched his arm. When his eyes flicked back up to me, the other side of his mouth had curled too, just a little. So go ahead and give her a call, he said. Tell her she's got a fine-looking young man with a sinful interest in her youngest son coming over, and to wear her pearls so she can clutch them at key moments in the evening. I let Jared's flirtation go without comment, just laughed, shook my head, and told him he was an idiot. Then I pulled my phone out of my pocket to call home and make plans. After I talked with my mom about dinner, we decided to go visit Jared's mom so he could let her know where he'd be when she got home from work later. Times Square Cafe sat on the Old Town Circle, just off the causeway, across from a small grocery store and a bait shop. It used to be an old Victorian inn called Diggers, back in the days when the lake wasn't a lake but a coal mining village. There was said to be a ghost inhabiting the second-floor rooms, the ghost of a woman who was jilted by a miner who had up and moved to West Virginia the day before their wedding without telling her. The wedding dress, Jared's mom told us that day as she poured us coffee at the bar, can't be removed. Anyone who's tried to throw it out finds its return the next day, hanging over the back of an old chair in the room directly above us. We both looked up at the high ceiling, where a brass chandelier with crystals hanging off it swayed a little, shaking off dust to sift down toward us like snowflakes. This was the sort of place we had available as a hangout in Temperance, a diner named after one of the most famous intersections of one of the most famous cities in the world, but really it was just this ancient inn filled with kitschy furniture and claw-footed tables. My mom loved the place. She said it had character, but it gave me the creeps. Libby, do you care if I eat dinner over at Aiden's tonight? Jared asked after we heard the Times Square Cafe ghost story to its tragic conclusion. That's fine by me, his mom said, not blinking. I, however, did a lot of blinking when I heard Jared call her by her first name. Make sure to thank Mrs. Lockwood, she added, and make sure not to overstay your welcome. Mrs. Doyle started to sort silverware then, and Jared said, Yes, ma'am. Which surprised me even more after he'd just got done calling her by her first name. Then Mrs. Doyle swung around to put the silverware tray behind the bar, and her hair, long and dark like Jared's, swayed like a curtain. She looked younger than I remembered, less worn out and ruined than the woman I recalled coming to school for a fourth-grade open house with a hangover the size of a tractor, she had told our mousy teacher, Mrs. Burroway, and a small flask of whiskey she kept taking out of her purse, then putting back when she realized where she was and what exactly she was doing. Don't worry, I said. I'll get Jared back in time to do his homework. Libby laughed, one short, sharp ha, and said, This one? Homework? All I can do is hope you'll be a good influence on him, Aiden. If he hadn't been the star pitcher for his school up in Cleveland, I'm not sure he'd have been given as many second chances as he's gotten used to having. Everyone deserves a second chance, Jared said, twirling a spoonful of cream into his coffee. His mom looked at him, her eyebrows raised, halfway between offended and guilty as charged. "Yes, everyone deserves a second chance," she said, with her voice lowered a little to challenge him. "But it's also good if everyone does their part to change their bad habits." Before their jabs became a full-blown battle, the cafe's front door swung open, and the bell above jingled its old-fashioned greeting. A couple of white-haired guys came in, saying, "Hey, Libby," like they were good friends, and waved from the other end of the room in all its dark wood and ornamental plaster glory. When I turned back, Jared's mom was already moving in their direction with a notepad, slipping a pen out of her apron pocket. "Why does she stay here?" I asked, once she was out of earshot. "She could make more money waiting tables out in Niles." "It's close to home," said Jared, lifting his cup. "So she saves on gas. And more important, they don't serve liquor here. Libby doesn't even want to carry it out to someone else on a tray." "I'll give her one thing," I said. "She's disciplined."
"Has to be."
Jared watched his mom smile with the old men at the other end of the room, laughing at their crusty jokes like they were actually funny. Who knows? Maybe they were.
"It's why she wants me to be more disciplined, too," he added.
"About drinking?" I asked.
"About everything," Jared said.
He spun around on his stool to face me. He had the same eyes as his mom, like I had my mother's, but where my eyes sparked green, his were dark and murky.
"She wants my grades up, my pitching impeccable, and for me to get a college scholarship at the end of the year."
"She's your mom," I said, as if that explained everything. "She wants good things for you." Jared accepted that without comment, and a minute later his mom slipped behind the counter to fill cups for her table. As she poured the coffee in a careful stream, Jared said,
"Hey, remember when you went to Aiden's mom a while back to ask about your future?"
I stiffened in my seat, and it looked like Libby did the same. She stopped pouring, straightened her back, and glared as if some man had made an unwanted advance on her.
"I do remember that," she said, nodding curtly. "Why do you ask?"
"We were just talking about it," Jared said, nodding toward me, making me an accomplice in whatever game he'd decided to play here. "What was it his mom told you again?"
"Jared." Libby shook her head, wincing. "It wasn't anything. Not what you're thinking, at least."
Then she turned to me, as if I had asked the question.
"When I got out of the center in Liberty a few years ago," she said, "I was feeling pretty down, as you can imagine. Your mom was real understanding, that's all. She came over a few times to check in on me. Always exactly at times I needed someone to talk to. And she told me not to worry. My stars were looking good," she said. "She was being a friend, that's all. Jared makes it seem like we were two witches brewing up some kind of magic in the kitchen."
She laughed, and I laughed with her. But Jared only grinned, like his mom and I were the foolish ones. Then he brought his cup of coffee up to his lips to sip at it.
"Anyway," said Libby, "I can't talk, boys. We're starting to get the early dinner crowd. The old folks like to get it out of the way before the place gets busy. Jared, I'll see you at home later. Aiden, it was good to see you, honey. I just saw your mom the other day, but tell her hi for me anyway."
"I will," I said. And Libby winked at me as she walked away to take care of people.
"I will," Jared mimicked after his mom was far enough away.
I rolled my eyes at him.
"Seriously?" he said. "What my mom just told you? That's nothing like how she described it a month ago when I moved home."
"How did she describe it then?"
"She said your mom saved her life when she was about to give up hope. She said your mom took her hand in hers and showed her a future my mom could continue to hope for. It sounded like what you do when you..."
"Reach across?" I said. Jared looked down at my hand, which lay on the counter near his.
"Yeah,"
he said, looking up again, blinking out a small spark of his own nearly extinguished hope.
"When you reach across."
"When did she change her story then?" I asked.
That's the thing, said Jared. Just a week or so ago, after your mom stopped in here to pay her a visit.
When we pulled down my driveway 20 minutes later, my mom was already on the front porch, waving as if she'd been there since I called, waiting to welcome home a war-ravaged soldier. I hadn't seen her so enthusiastic in a long time. Usually she kept to herself, stayed at home as much as possible, only went out for groceries and to run important errands, made rare expeditions to visit old friends like Jared's mom every now and then. When Toby and I were younger, she'd been more outgoing, never missed a parent-teacher conference, never missed a chance to help out at a bake sale, and took us once a week to the library. Now here she was, a virtual hermit, coming out to greet Jared with a big hug and an, "Oh my goodness, you have grown so tall, young man! I can't believe it!" Seriously, it was cringeworthy. It was like she was performing or something. It was not only unbelievable because she was usually reserved, but also because not 3 nights ago she'd seen my spirit outside of my body, returning home after riding a white stag during a war where I'd witnessed my great-grandfather die. Now suddenly she wanted to pretend everything was warm, homespun happiness. Once we got the pleasantries over with and went inside, she had us sit at the kitchen table so we could continue talking as she cooked. It was the time of day when I usually found her there with her tablet, absorbed in the news of the world, filtered through her online portal. But today, she'd already started to prepare a meal. The house smelled of lemon chicken, my favorite, and she'd pulled out a bottle of white wine. It was already uncorked and breathing on the dining room table in an ice bucket.
"So tell me what's up," she said.
Before we could answer, though, she opened the oven door to peek at the pecan pie and added, "It's so good to have you back home again, Jared."
"Thanks, Mrs. Lockwood," Jared said.
He dipped his head in her direction politely, even though her back was turned to him.
"It's good to be back."
"I'm sure it is."
She closed the oven and came over to sit with us at the table then, where she put her hand on Jared's forearm and said,
"I'm so glad you're home with your mom now. She's missed you something awful."
"We're doing good again."
Jared nodded briefly, then moved the arm my mother had been patting to scratch his chin. When he lowered his hand again, he said,
"I always thought I'd find myself back here someday anyhow."
"Really?"
My mom raised her eyebrows a little.
"What made you think that?"
"I would think that most young people who leave this place don't ever look back." Jared didn't say anything for a second. He just met my mom's waiting stare. I could see him trying to figure out an answer. He knew she was more than an ordinary mother making dinner. He knew she'd done something to change the way his mom remembered things recently, same as she'd messed with the memories of her own family. And he knew what my mom had told me about harbingers of death and the world's shadow. So there my mom sat, lifting a cup of coffee to her lips, sipping it while keeping her eyes locked with Jared's.
"I guess," he finally said, "that living in a city didn't really take with me."
"Interesting," said my mom.
Then she stood and went to pull plates down from a cupboard. Looking over her shoulder as she reached up to the shelves, she said,
"I've always felt I wouldn't want to live anywhere but Temperance. We must be kindred spirits that way, you and me."
Jared gave her a friendly grin, but when she turned back to the cupboard, he looked at me and made a face that said, "Your mom is a total alien." 20 minutes later, my dad and Toby came through the back door, knocking their work boots off in the mudroom, hanging up their coats. When they stepped up into the kitchen and saw Jared at the table between my mom and me, my dad got a big smile on his face and said,
"Why, Mr. Doyle, it's been a while,"
and held his hand out for Jared to shake. My brother followed suit, and before long they were all sitting around the dining room table as my mom and I brought out food. Toby had already caught Jared up on the local high school baseball scene, which Toby still followed. He said he'd heard Jared was pitching some mean games up in Cleveland, and Jared said,
"Well, I've got a good fastball, but I need to work on my curve."
"Everything straight down the center, no looking back, just like your father," said my dad,
grunting afterward. Jared was the kind of son he could have easily been proud of, like Toby.
"Josh was always a straight shooter," he said, "in life and in baseball. How's he doing, by the way?"
Jared sort of flinched at the mention of his dad. Or maybe he flinched at the mention of being straight down the center, when in reality he wasn't straight at all. But I guess you wouldn't notice a flinch that slight if you didn't know his dad had thrown him out because he'd been caught making out with a guy in his bedroom. I felt bad sitting there, knowing his secret. It seemed to gather behind him now, like a dark cloud he hoped no one would notice. But I did. I noticed. Every day I saw his secret follow him around, like some mangy mutt he'd been too nice to. Jared glanced my way, as if he was worried I'd tell everyone, but I looked down at my plate, where my mom's chicken and rice waited, and let him recover. I knew the truth about why he'd come back, but I also knew something else, that he wanted me. That he wanted me to want him back in a way I wasn't sure I could. It was almost as if I had to not look at him now, knowing all that, so he could go on being normal with my family. He told my dad that his father was doing fine, still working at the car factory, still going to Indians games despite record losses, and when he was finally back in a good rhythm of talking about all things baseball, I looked up again, slowly, to watch him when he wouldn't notice me looking. He was so animated, not hesitant, like he'd been initially. I found myself watching the curve of his jaw as he spoke, the line sharp as a sickle. And the way he kept brushing his hair from his eyes. How he waved his fork around to illustrate whatever he was talking about. He was... I didn't know. I wasn't sure how to express in words about what I felt right then. Especially about another guy. For as long as I could remember, I'd assumed that one day I'd run into some girl who jarred me out of my haze. Maybe on one of those after-school drives down the back roads of Temperance. Or maybe once I'd discovered my true destination during one of those drives, the home I was looking for. And everything for the rest of my life would just fall into place, like it does for most people. But here I was, feeling something else. A vague and possibly dangerous emotion. I wasn't on one of my backroad drives, though, and there was no girl waking me up from the spell of confusion I'd been under. There was this guy instead. This guy who had called my name in the hallway. This guy who had made me look up and realize that nothing around me was what I thought it was. Not even myself. It was while I was staring at Jared, trying to sort through those unexpected and confusing feelings, that I noticed something other than me was out of place in that room. A shadow. A real shadow that didn't belong to anyone in our house. At first it seemed like the light in the room dimmed, as if the flow of electricity through the house was about to wink out. And then the shadow suddenly slipped out of a corner of the room to come and stand behind Jared's chair. At first it was just this dark, vaguely human shape. But as I continued to watch, the shadow took on full definition, a hazy layer of color developing like an old-fashioned photograph, antique and blurry, until I could make out the figure of a woman. I opened my mouth, but I couldn't manage to say anything as the shadow put her hands on Jared's shoulders and leaned down to whisper in his ear. He just sat there, talking with my father and brother as if he didn't feel her behind him, as if he couldn't hear her spinning her voice inside him, the voice she sometimes spun inside me. Who was she? And what was she telling him? If she had her way, would Jared eventually wake to find himself standing under the living death tree in the orchard? "What are you doing to him?" I finally managed to say. And everyone at the table turned to look at me. "Aiden?" my dad said, his face a mess of confusion. "What are you talking about?" The woman's shadow disappeared in an instant, like smoke clearing after a magic trick, and my mom, looking more startled than anyone else in the room, said, "Yes, just what are you talking about, Aiden?" Toby held a fork full of chicken in midair and looked at me like I was a crazy person. But when I turned to Jared, He only looked at me with his dark, steady eyes, undisturbed by my outburst, waiting to hear what I'd say next. And I knew right then that whatever I said, he'd be on my side. "It's just," I said, trying to think of an alternate explanation for my outburst, since the truth would not have gone over well with anyone but my mom, and not even her, really, since it would have brought up the sort of things she'd asked me not to mention to my dad and brother. "It's just that you guys are talking Jared's ears off. Give him some breathing room, or he probably won't come back to visit." Jared laughed at this answer, and the tension in the room evaporated. "Oh, don't worry," he said. "I'll be back, as long as your mom promises to make dinner again. This is delicious, by the way, Mrs. Lockwood." My dad laughed, too, now that he'd been prompted to find my outburst humorous. And with that, I knew I'd escaped what could have been an explosive moment. My mom turned her attention to Jared now, saying that he was quite the charmer and that she'd make him a meal whenever he wanted. "As long as you can guarantee that my son won't bite everyone's heads off in the middle of dinner," she added, turning to raise her eyebrows at me, as if she couldn't believe my behavior. Then she speared a piece of broccoli with her fork, fast and sharp, like a hunter going in for the kill. I let the comment go, and I waited. Waited to get through the rest of dinner. Waited to get through dessert. Waited to be excused from chores that night, since I had a guest over, so Jared and I could go up to my room to hang out like we were completely normal 17-year-olds, away from everyone else for the evening. "What was that all about?" Jared asked after I'd closed my bedroom door behind us a little later. "Something raised your hackles back there, didn't it?" I slipped my hands into my pockets and looked out my bedroom window at the dark line of trees behind the pasture, where I'd exited the woods on the back of a white stag a few nights before. "Yeah," I said, nodding. "I saw something down there, in the room with us." "What was it?" Jared asked. I could feel him step closer as I stood with my back to him, heard the creak of floorboards beneath his feet, as if he were sneaking up on me like the shadow had snuck up on him. "There was a woman down in the room with us," I said. "I saw her doing something to you. I don't know how to explain it. She came out of the corner to stand behind you. She leaned down and whispered something in your ear. That's when I freaked out at the table." "You're kidding me," Jared said. I could almost feel his breath on the back of my neck as he formed his words behind me. I shook my head. "No," I said. "She went away after that, but I know what I saw. She was doing something to you. She was telling you something, but in whispers. I couldn't hear her." Moonlight glinted on the dewy November grass so that it sparkled like a field of stars below my window. I thought of the probable stone, the star my mom had pointed out in the memory she'd given back to me. I wanted to find it right then, to touch it, to ask the star to take me home again, wherever home was. Because where I was didn't feel like home any longer. It couldn't be home, so full of mismatched memories and shadows that hovered in corners. My house was haunted, but by who or what, I didn't know. Sometimes it felt like it was maybe me, my old self, the one I'd forgotten, doing the haunting, waiting for me to turn around and see who I used to be. "There's no one else for me to trust," I said. "Not even my family. I've never been able to talk to my dad, and even though I love my brother, we've never been really close, you know? And my mom, well..." I stopped there for a moment, shaking my head and wincing a little, not wanting to feel the hurt and anger that welled up whenever I thought about her these days. "I don't know who she is anymore," I continued. "There's just you. You're the only person who doesn't feel like a stranger right now. Even though I haven't seen you in years, even though I can't remember everything about us, I can feel you inside me, in all the memories I can't recall anymore. There's just you." I couldn't face him as I said those things. It was too hard to say something that made me feel that vulnerable. so I kept looking out the window, where in the glass I could see a reflection of Jared's face hovering over my shoulder.
"I'm glad you can trust me, Aiden," he said. "But if we're going to be completely honest with each other, I have something else to tell you."
"What?" I asked, hoping it wouldn't be some other huge problem for me to figure out. I had enough of those to handle.
"I told you that my dad kicked me out because he caught me with another guy."
"Yeah," I said.
"Well, that's true. But it wasn't really completely innocent on my part."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean," said Jared, "that I set myself up to be caught that night."
"Why?"
I asked. I could see my own brow furrowing and my reflection in the window.
"Because," said Jared, "my dad wouldn't let me move back in with my mom, even though she's been clean and on track for a while now.
And I needed to get back here somehow, to help you if I could. So I brought that guy home after picking him up outside a club one night, and I made sure it was when my dad would be coming home from his night shift. I made sure we were, well, you know, not quiet. So my dad would come in and see us like that."
"How did you know I'd need your help?" I asked, shaking my head, unable to comprehend why he'd go so far out on a limb for me. Unable to comprehend how he even knew I'd need him.
"Because one of the things you showed me when we were 13 was this time in your life, when you wouldn't know yourself any longer. You didn't understand how it would happen, but you knew it would. You showed it all to me. And you asked me to come help you remember things if I could."
"You're kidding," I said.
"I'm not," said Jared. "For a while after my dad moved us to Cleveland, I'd think about you and all that stuff. With each year that passed, I started to tell myself maybe I'd imagined all the weird things you were able to do and see, all the things you'd shown me. But at the end of this summer, I dreamed about you, and I hadn't done that in a long time. When I woke up, I couldn't get the dream out of my head. I felt like you'd sent it to me, like a message. A few weeks passed, and I kept having dreams about you. And I saw you like you are now, not like the 13-year-old I'd left behind. So I knew they were more than ordinary dreams. That's when I brought that guy home, so my dad would discover the truth about his perfect son and send me to live with my mom, since he couldn't stand to look at me any longer. And here you are," I said.
"And here I am," said Jared.
I turned around quickly to tell him what an idiot he was for taking that kind of risk, and he was right there, his face inches from mine, waiting for me, waiting for this moment. Like maybe all those years ago I'd shown him this moment happening too, and he'd positioned himself to be ready for it. His warm breath fluttered against my lips, and it smelled of peppermint.
"I saw this moment in a vision you showed me once, a long time ago," he said now, confirming my suspicions.
His voice was low in his throat, almost like he was frightened of what he was saying. His eyes were dark, and something in them glittered. I struggled with how close we were, with how I was almost pressed up against the window with only an inch or two between us, but I managed to overcome my fears and tell him what I had to. "If I showed you this exact moment years ago," I said, "then you know what to do next, don't you?" I could feel my body trembling and tried to calm it. Jared nodded, but he didn't do what I thought he would, not right away. Instead, he said,
"Are you sure about this?"
And I nodded, closed my eyes like that might help me go through with it blindfolded. I'd been blindfolded for years by then anyway. I was used to not seeing.
"I don't know," Jared said a second later. "You seem afraid."
"I am afraid," I admitted. But I opened my eyes again, looked at him for one long moment.
"There," he whispered now. "That's better."
Then he put his hands on my cheeks and leaned in to kiss me. There was a moment in that kiss where I felt like I'd been thrown over the side of a ship into the depths of the ocean, and I split into two people. The me who'd been thrown overboard, and the me watching myself falling down and down through the dark blue water, unconscious, floating, my arms flung out like a jellyfish, formless, my eyes closed, drifting down and farther down to the bottom of an endless nothing. I'm going to drown, I thought. I'm going to lose myself entirely. And then my drowning body opened its eyes, looked from side to side, saw the glimmering of sunlight filtering from above, and began to swim toward it, pulling upward and farther upward in long strokes. I opened my eyes an instant later, inhaling deeply as Jared and I pulled away from each other. "What do you think?" he said, blinking his dark eyes, stroking my cheek with one fingertip. "Is this okay?" I could have answered him with words. I could have said, "Yes, it's okay. And it's more than okay." But instead I just nodded, put my hands on his cheeks like he'd put his on mine, and threw myself overboard a second time. Chapter 8. In the World's Shadow. November would be good. I kept telling myself that it had to be good after the insanity of October. So life wasn't what I thought, I told myself. So what if I could sometimes see into the future or the past? So what if I could unintentionally slip into something my mother called the world's shadow if I wasn't careful? So what if I'd gotten up on the back of a harbinger of death, as my mother called the white stag, and rode it home through time and space? So what if I'd seen another harbinger of death walk into my seventh grade classroom on the day he planned to claim the life of my teacher, and couldn't remember because my mom had hidden some of my own memories from me? So what if I'd made out with a guy in my bedroom while my family watched television in the room below? So what? November would be good, I told myself. It had to be. Otherwise, I was going to self-combust. Over the last few weeks, the leaves of temperance had changed from yellow and red to the deep brown of late autumn. Throughout the day, the wind would strip them from the trees, one by one, and float them through the air until they gathered at the foot of our porch steps, spread them across the expanse of the high school parking lot, or lined them up along the windowsills of houses. Leaves got caught beneath windshield wipers, and whenever rain came and I turned the wipers on, the leaves would fly up and away after being released, to drift through the air like paratroopers. Wherever I looked, it was a golden brown landscape I moved through. Winter was coming down the line, though. I knew it when my dad and Toby took a day off work to go hunting and came back with a young buck, which they hung from the basketball hoop on the front of our garage to drain its blood, staining the gravel beneath the hoop a sticky black for weeks to come. And I knew it when my mom started to decorate the house for the coming holidays. Jared and I spent the first half of November trying to figure each other out. Since he understood what we were doing together better than I did, I let him take the lead. And because of what my mom had done, cut me off from parts of myself, it felt like I was speaking a foreign language. You, me, this thing between us. I didn't always know what to do or how to do it, but I moved toward this feeling Jared created in me just by being near him. I touched his chest, looked into his eyes. He stared back, and his lips were rough against mine. This wasn't how it was supposed to be, though, was it? Nothing. Nothing I'd been told by my family and teachers, by books and TV. None of it meant much to me any longer. And I had to figure out a way to live with my mom without hating her for messing with my head and lying to me, even though she said it was for my own protection. What a parent thing to say. That excuse, like everything else, didn't mean much to me. "Let's take it slow," I told Jared, even though I wanted to pack a bag and hit the road, ride to some other place where I could kiss him on a street corner. Go someplace where we could figure each other out without worrying that anyone was looking at us, staring. Places like that existed. Temperance just wasn't one of them. It was hard to ignore how different life here was from what we saw on TV and the internet. Guys and girls were the norm here. If there was anything other than that, I'd never seen it. It was hard not to think that the right life for us was probably elsewhere.
"Don't worry,"
Jared said, stroking my arm, raising goosebumps. He took my hand, looked at me through the locks of hair falling across his eyes, and said,
"I'm not going anywhere."
But how could I know that for sure? Hadn't he gone away before? And hadn't my mom made me forget important things? It seemed to me that nothing could be certain, that people couldn't be trusted, not even your own family. Life could change your circumstances and whisk you away, or else someone could do something horrible to you, maybe without you even realizing it. And when you did realize it, they'd say it was for your own good. "It's just that I don't know how to be myself," I said. I was holding on to his hand, like if I didn't, I might float up through the air, into the clouds and into outer space, and then I'd keep on floating until I reached a planet with a gravity strong enough to hold me. This world, this town, my family, it all felt like I could put my hands through it, like there was nothing here but smoke and mirrors.
"You don't have to know how to be yourself," Jared said, running his thumb across my knuckles. "You just are yourself. You don't think it. You just feel it."
"But everything I feel," I said, "none of those feelings can be real if I've been lied to. That's what she's done to me. She's made my whole life into a lie."
"She messed up," Jared said, shrugging. "All of our parents do. They think they're doing good things for us, and sometimes they are. But other times, they're doing things that are just convenient. I'm sure my mom used to think one more sip of whiskey could calm her nerves so she could take better care of me. I'm sure my dad thought by kicking me out, he'd kick the queer right out of me. People fuck up, Aiden. Your mom's no different just because she's, I don't know. What the hell is she? Did she explain that to you, at least?"
"You mean, what the hell are we?" I said. "Her and me both." I wanted him to remember that I was as strange as she was, so he didn't blind himself to that and then later change his mind about me. "And no," I shook my head, "she didn't explain any of it. Said she doesn't know what we are, just that we're like anyone. Said she thinks most people can do what we do, if they would only let themselves." Jared made a face like what I was saying was pure garbage. "Yeah," I said. "She's still lying. I know she knows more. She just won't tell me."
"Maybe it really is for the best, then,"
Jared said, sitting up against his headboard and stretching out his arms. He'd been lying beside me for the past hour, working me through tangled feelings, probably hoping we could do something far more interesting. But he listened to me. He asked questions. "How can it be for the best?" I asked. "You're starting to sound like her now."
"I don't know, Aiden."
He got out of bed, running his fingers through his hair.
"It's just that whatever's happening here, it's big. Maybe it's best not to know everything. I know that sounds like a cop-out, but you're already freaking out about what you do know. Finding out more might be enough to crack you."
He came to stand near where I sat on the edge of his bed, bent down on one knee, then put his hand in my hair to ruffle it a little.
"And I don't want to see you break," he said. "Not after just getting you back again."
It was weird to find myself in this position, especially with my family. Not because I was secretly having a relationship with Jared while everyone assumed we were just friends, but because of the secret I kept from my mom. "Don't bring up any of the things I've shared with you to your dad or brother," was what she'd said after I'd ridden home on the back of a white stag, when she'd finally talked openly about the things I was starting to see and hear that autumn.
"But don't they already know?" I'd asked.
"Toby doesn't," she'd said, shaking her head vigorously. "He never had the sight you have, not to that degree, so it's best to just leave him be. Your father once knew about all of this, yes." She'd looked down at her hands, where her fingers slowly twisted together in her lap, fidgeting.
"What do you mean, once knew?"
And she had looked up with her lips pursed, unable to meet my eyes, and said, "I helped him forget some things, the same way I did with you."
"Mom," I'd said,
but she'd hushed me.
"It's better this way," she said.
"Our lives are much better separated from the things I hid from you and your father.
Please, Aiden, help me keep it this way. I just want us all to be happy."
Grudgingly, I'd agreed. What else could I have done, really? Run and told my brother I'd seen our great-grandfather in the war that killed him? Run and told my dad that my mom had somehow made him forget things, that she'd done something to make him remember his life differently from the way it had actually occurred? They would have looked at me like I was crazy. So the days passed as if they were normal. And then Thanksgiving came around just in time for my family to really get some good practice at being ordinary. We spent that day in the usual way, watching the parade on television, eating turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, like any average American family. Even though my mom and I sat across the table from each other, withholding a secret from my dad and brother while we ate slices of pumpkin pie. Our eyes met every so often, but my mom was always the first to look away, which made me realize just how much she required my silence. It was only a couple of weeks later, when everyone had just gotten used to the idea of December, that the house phone rang in the middle of the night. Across the hall, I heard my dad's voice, thick with sleep, say,
"Snow? Really? That much? This early?"
And his voice kept going up and up as he spoke, drifting across the space between us, slipping beneath my doorway, like the voice of the living death tree seemed to manifest right there in my room sometimes, a disembodied presence. Snow usually didn't fall this early in December, and never that much when it did. But when I got up and went to the window, sure enough, it was falling fast and thick over the fields in the back pasture. It must have been falling like that for hours, too, because the ground was covered, and my car had become this amorphous whiteness sitting in front of the garage. I looked down at my phone. It was 5 in the morning, and the town was already buried in nearly a foot, according to my local weather app. When I heard my dad buckling his belt and zipping up his coat, I left the window to go downstairs, arriving just in time to see him close the front door behind him. Snow still floated in the entryway where he'd been standing. The flakes hung in midair for one long moment, almost suspended in time, before they drifted to the floor and turned into drops of pearled water. My mom, too, was awake already. I found her in the kitchen, sitting at the table with a glass of water, her hair draped over her shoulders in uncombed strands. When I first came in and saw her under the fluorescent glare of the kitchen light, the fine lines that crowded the corners of her eyes seemed to cut deeper than usual. A bit of makeup usually hid the age that had crept up on my mom over the past few years, but without that polish, she looked more worn down than I was used to seeing her.
"You should go back to bed," she said, putting her glass down when she saw me in the doorway. "They're going to cancel school soon anyway."
She was right. The house phone rang again not 20 minutes later. My mom took the call, listening to the recorded message from the principal, even though she already knew what was coming. Before she'd even had a chance to shout the news to me from the kitchen, the weatherman on the news station I'd put on in the living room predicted that the snow would keep coming for the next few days. And after hearing that, in true Midwestern mother fashion, my mom decided we'd better stock up on necessities before things got worse, and she drove off 10 minutes later, headed for the grocery store, where I was sure a mass of Temperance's parents were already gathering. The first night of any string of winter days my dad was gone because of work was almost always a magical experience, at least initially, because his absence let the rest of us do whatever we wanted. Toby would watch TV without having to fight with my dad over the remote. My mom would open a bottle of wine and lie in bed reading a mystery novel, sipping from her glass until the bottle was empty. Me? I'd wander down into the basement, a space we usually avoided because my dad kept his woodworking machines and taxidermy tools down there, and he didn't want us messing around with them. These were hobbies he indulged in whenever he had free time. I liked to go down there when he wasn't around, to examine the things he made below the floors where we lived out our daily lives. Running my fingers along the leg of a stool still clamped on the lathe, stroking the back of my hand against the fur of a deer's preserved muzzle, both made me feel like I was somehow trespassing, but also like I was able to understand something about my dad, who was quiet and didn't share his thoughts with anyone too readily, unless he was angry, and then everything he thought, good or bad, came spilling out of him. The things he made in the basement were like hieroglyphs found in an Egyptian tomb, and I ran my fingers over them, hoping to somehow know him better. After the first day of snow, he'd usually come home and the roads would be clear and everyone's lives would go back to normal. We'd eat dinner and he'd fight with Toby over the TV, and my mom would only have one glass of wine at dinner. This snowstorm, though, was different. The first night passed in that magical, absent dad way, but in the morning, when he hadn't come home to pick up Toby, my mom called the roads department, worried. No one was there to answer her call, though. The answering service came on instead, telling her to leave her name and number, saying that someone would be in touch as soon as possible. They were working as fast as they could. She called my dad's cell phone afterward, and luckily he answered. "The snow won't quit," he said. "Me and the other guys have our work cut out. Stay home. Tell Toby not to answer his phone if a supervisor calls, or else you answer and tell them he's sick. I don't want him on these roads." When another day passed without my dad coming home, my mom began to stop in the middle of doing things. She'd look out a window suddenly, as if she'd just heard my dad's truck pulling into the driveway, but who knows what she saw out there. Phantoms, maybe. It was never my dad. The driveway was always empty. Toby got the tractor started on the third day and drove it 15 miles to the Rose Department, ignoring my mom's pleas for him to do as his father said and stay home. A few hours later he returned, covered in a layer of frost that had formed on him as he drove out in the open air. Looking like a snowman as he stood before us in the kitchen, he said, "All the crews have been called in and are overnighting it. There are a bunch of trees down, and the roads are almost impassable in some places. Dad said he'd be back as soon as he's able." Which made my mom sigh, relieved to know that he was okay. When he didn't come home that night, though, when my mom had to later pack his dinner away in the refrigerator, her forehead started to crease with concern again. I began to worry, too. Jared had texted several times over the course of that day to say, "Hey, your dad just drove past my place with his plow," letting us know that he was out there in the world, safe, doing his job. But now those occasional notifications were cold comfort. On the fourth day, my dad called near midnight to tell my mom that the storm seemed like it was never-ending, and that was when she and I stayed up together, avoiding the stare of my suicidal grandfather, watching the hands of my Grandma Benny's old cuckoo clock slowly sweep across the hours. "This isn't natural," my mother said to finally break our silence. She looked out the front window at the rolling hills of snow, at the buried bushes, at the trees sheathed in cases of glinting ice. Everything glinted under the cold glare of a full moon. We were like those small figures of people in snow globes, I thought, trapped in a tiny town under glass. "What do you mean?" I asked her. "I mean someone's done this," she said. "Someone's wished this into being." "What?" I asked again. It was the first time she'd talked openly, without any coded references, since she'd made me promise not to tell anyone about these things I'd been hearing and seeing since October. I was hoping I could find out more now, while an emergency distracted her from keeping her secrets. "There's a wish behind all of this," she said matter-of-factly, as if she were my physics teacher talking about gravity. "A wish that comes from sorrow and anger. Can you see the tears behind the flakes as they fall?" She pulled back the curtain a little more to show me, and I pressed my face closer to the window. I couldn't see anything like tears falling behind snowflakes, but I knew they were there if my mother said she saw them. "Wishes made in sorrow or in pain are powerful creations," she said, dropping the curtain again. "Sometimes they come from people who are too caught up in their feelings to realize what they've even done." "A wish," I said, "can actually be made?" My mother nodded, her lips pursed in thought, as if she didn't like the idea of wishes, but had to acknowledge their existence. "Curses, too," she said. "If a person knows how to bring them into being."
"How?"
I asked. She shook her head, eyes heavily lidded. "It's too much to explain right now. I've got to deal with this blizzard."
"How?"
She turned back to the window then, and I noticed her fingertips rubbing against the palm of her hand nervously. "I have to go into the world's shadow to change this," she said. "And I'll need you to look after me. Here, at home. I might be gone for a while. And if I'm not back in a few hours, I'll need you to wake me."
"You can do that?"
I asked, thinking of how, not long ago, I'd been unexpectedly swept away to a battlefield in France during World War II.
"You can go there when you want to?
Like, on purpose?" She nodded, eyes closed, like she was ashamed of all the things that she still hadn't taught me.
"You can," she said, opening her eyes again. "But you shouldn't do it unless you absolutely have to."
"Why won't you tell me about these things?" I asked, throwing my hands in the air, shaking them with each word that I said, the same way my dad did whenever he got angry. "Why don't you trust me?"
"Aiden," she said, "it's not you I distrust, and I don't have time for this right now. I have to change things. This blizzard has been caused by someone, and I think your father may be in danger because of it. Will you or won't you wake me if I don't get up on my own in a few hours?"
"I will," I said. "That's easy enough." Her face was grim, but she nodded, grateful for my agreement.
"If I don't wake at first," she said, "you'll have to keep trying. Shake me. Throw water on me if you have to."
"Are you sure you want to do this?"
"I have to," she said. "This has nothing to do with wanting."
We climbed the staircase together then, and before she stretched out on her bed, she took the old silver pocket watch, the one her father had given her, and clutched it in her hands. I took a seat on a chair beside her nightstand, watching as she stared up at the ceiling, breathing deeply, as if she were about to plunge under water, stroking the round case of the watch like a favored pet. Then she began to count backward from 100, stating the numbers slowly, solemnly, as if she were recalling the words of a spell. And when her lips parted to finally say 0, her eyes closed abruptly, and the word flew out of her mouth like a snowflake, melting in midair. After that, she was gone. She was there on her bed, but I could tell she was gone. And her body remained behind, an empty vessel. Like I must have been gone. Like I must have been still as stone, looking like a person who died in his sleep when I parachuted into a forest in France with my great-grandfather Lockwood. I sat beside her like a guard now, wondering how I'd make it through the next couple of hours, wondering who could have sent a blizzard to endanger my father, like my mom suspected, frustrated that I couldn't do anything. Frustrated that my mom wouldn't teach me about these things I needed to know in order to actually help. My mother had done this on purpose, I reminded myself then. She'd gone into the world's shadow by willing it. What else could she do? Could I do that I didn't know about? She kept too many secrets, my mother, and I kept bumping up against them like furniture in a dark room. I went up and down the staircase several times for a while after that, before I realized I was pacing. 100 to 0, I was thinking as I reached the upstairs landing for probably the 4th or 5th round of anxiety-driven stair climbing. Just lie back and close your eyes. Slip inside like a shadow, like slipping a hand into a glove. I stopped pacing then. I was tired of feeling useless, tired of having this ability and not being told how to use it. I'd gotten back from the world's shadow once before. I could do it again, I figured. I headed straight to my room then, where I stretched out on my bed and looked up at the crack etching its way across the ceiling, and stared at that dark crevasse for a long time, breathing deeply, like my mom had done before she went under. The longer I stared, the wider the crack seemed to grow, to widen, to deepen, until suddenly it was a chasm above me, a dark canyon with wind howling through it, pulling me up toward it, lifting me higher and higher, closer and closer, like a person possessed by a spirit. Everything that made up the ordinary world I moved through, all the laws we're forced to live by, natural and man-made, felt like they'd been undone. The crack in the ceiling was a space I could fall into if I wanted, if I'd only let myself fall upward into the sky above. I began the count backward from 100 then, and closed my eyes to the world as I reached 0, only to open them again in the world's shadow. At first there was the boy. The dog came after. There was the boy, and then there was a black lab trotting behind him. Then the boy slapped his hip lightly in signal, and the dog hurried to catch up and walk alongside him. He was a squinty-eyed kid, 15 or 16, wearing blue jeans and a brown barn jacket with a sheepskin collar warming the back of his neck. He was walking through the back field, a field I would have recognized in any season, because it had always been what I saw spread out beyond my bedroom window. Though this particular season was not the winter I'd left behind me, but autumn, and the tree line at the back of the field blazed with color. "Be careful now," a voice called from behind the boy, and he turned to look at the back of the yellow clapboard house, where his mother sat on the stoop snapping the last of the beans from her summer garden. Benny. My grandma Benny. Only much younger than I'd ever seen her. She had a face already worn out by the world, with lines around her dark eyes and early gray curling into her brown hair. "And make sure your father knows it'll be time for dinner soon, if you can drag him out of there when you find him," she said. The boy nodded. He was waving goodbye to her even as he turned back to the woods, to trudge through the rain-sopped field in his gumboots with the black dog trotting beside him. There was a sun that day, too, hovering over the trees on the horizon, orange and bleary, smearing the sky with its brassy oils. There was a slight wind at the boy's back, gently nudging him into the amber-lit forest. And there were the usual movements of squirrels and birds and rabbits, chatter and sing-song, the shifting of brush and leaves as creatures turned themselves invisible at his approach. The dog, however, could sense them. It lifted its black nose, turned its ears in one direction, then another, every time it heard some tiny thing scuttle into a cold hole or into one of the ant-hollowed logs that littered the trails of the forest. The dog left the boy's side to circle around for a while, patrolling, until the boy slapped his hip again and the dog returned, tail flicking back and forth, and peered over its shoulder at whatever it had wanted to apprehend. The boy went to these woods often. So often, in fact, that he had brought them into his mind over a long period of time and could now walk through them in his dreams. He pressed his face against his pillow each night, after feeding and watering the cows in the barn with his father, and walked through the world contained within him, the world his father and his grandfather had known before him. This land. These woods. He walked the footpaths they had worn into the earth during their years here, over the bridge and into the orchard, where the